So I'll come to someone will be getting married term time, and Shmuley will be getting married right at the Pesach before Shira, for sure. So yeah, we're looking forward to that. So before we start tonight's Shira, I just wanted to tell you how much the Shira that we gathered together to do together actually helped me. Because the last Shira that I gave, right, the last week was Hanukkah, so we were off last week. So the Shira before that, we were doing the Chol Me'odecha, with every measure and measure that Hashem gives you, whether for the good or whether for the hardship, you know, the positive, the negative. I guess I'm not supposed to use the word bad, but, you know, positive or negative as we view them, it all comes from Hashem. So it happened to be that the week, so Shmuley got engaged with Marguerite on Moshi Shabbos. That was, let's say, Thursday was the 26th. Okay, so Moshi Shabbos they got engaged, and then the next Friday, just like within the week on Friday, I was headed home from work at about noon on Friday. It was, of course, a short Friday, and I was going to make it just a quiet, simple Shabbos. And obviously, I made some kind of miscalculation because I stopped at Green Bank. I stopped at the pharmacy on Green Bank at the Shoppers, and I was going to make a left turn coming out of the pharmacy onto Green Bank towards Hunt Club. Like towards Metro. And I was watching, the cars were all coming, so I waited, the light turned red, I waited for all the cars to come, so I proceeded to make my left turn. Unfortunately, there was somebody, a car there, that I did not see, I'm not sure where she came from, I waited for all the cars to come, so as I'm making the left turn, she was coming, she hit into me, and then we kind of traveled towards the left together.
Oh.
So we collided. And I couldn't get out now, yeah. So Barbara
was
two Shabbos ago. The
fourth.
Down the fourth. Like at noon on Friday, you know, when like the kids got out of school at 2 and Shabbos was at 4, that kind of Friday. So we kind of saw that I wanted to get out of the car, but I couldn't get out my door because my door was attached to her car. So I had to climb out the passenger side. And, you know, thank God she was okay. I got out on my own 2 feet, but I was okay. I had some bruising on my chin and my ankle. I must have hit my ankle on, like, the brake pedal or something as we swerved and slammed. And at the time, I didn't feel it, but my neck acted up afterwards, some whiplash or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I was just like in seventh heaven, like so thrilled, my son's engaged, I have a daughter-in-law, like life is perfect, everything is going well. And right away came to my mind was the fear. I said, okay, Shango, the whole Mida Umida. You had your excitement, you had your Mazel Tov, you still have your Mazel Tov. Now you have your little bit of a collision over here. And the whole Mida Umida, I don't understand the collision, but I was thinking back to that day. Basically, I finished teaching on Friday when the kids get out at 2 o'clock. I finished teaching at 10:15. Recess is at 10:15. So I had some work to do for school, and I told myself I am not leaving work until I finished the work that I had to do, because I knew once I came home, I wasn't going to do it. So while I was doing the work that I need to take care of for school, like some preparing, I also had a phone call to make, because what happened? A friend and I were looking online for a gown for, she was looking for a gown for her sister-in-law's wedding, I was looking for a gown for the kids' wedding, and we were just kept emailing websites back and forth to each other, check this out, you like this one, you like that one, and she found one that I liked, I said, okay, I'm going to order it. So Friday morning, I probably should have been on my way to work, but my mate the hunter went out, and I'm ordering this gown. And it says, for sizing information, click here. So I'm looking at the sizing information, and it says, petite. I'm like, perfect. Then I always have to hem everything. And this, well, I didn't have sleeves. I didn't have to worry about the sleeves being too long. But I think, okay, if I get petite, then I won't have to make such a big of a hem, and maybe I won't have to hem it at all, because it's made for 5'4 and under, right? Perfect. Okay, so I order it, and I get a confirmation. You know, your order has been placed, perfect. And I'm looking at it, and it doesn't say petite. It just says the number without the petite sign. And I'm like, oh, you say that you're in such a rush, because you should have been in work. You should have left. You didn't go to work. You're ordering the gown. You're in a rush, and you're not even paying attention to what you're doing. You order the work. So, okay, so I get to work. And while I'm doing my work, you know, after the class is dismissed, I'm waiting on hold for the company to tell them that I need them to fix the order. So basically, I was on hold for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and then finally I get to speak to somebody, and I go through the whole spiel, how I was so excited to order the gown, and the size of it, and I order the petite, but now I see it's not a petite, can't she change the order? And she says the only thing she can do is cancel the order, and then we could reorder it. She can't really, because the dress doesn't come from them. They get it from, like, outsourced. Mm-hmm. So it won't, like, it's not like an internal department thing that she doesn't have control over. So I say, fine. Okay. So we cancel the whole order. And then we go and we reorder it again. So we reorder it again, and Ingo might be goofy, but I guess I'm not as goofy as I think. I didn't order petite because there was no petite. It only is available in the regular number sizes. I looked at the chart and probably it was not available, whatever it is. So basically I sat on hold, canceled the order, rebought the same thing that I bought, which was really the right thing because there was no such thing as what I thought I ordered or what I wanted to order. And then she tells me, so they usually get the cancellation in time, especially since you just did it like a couple of hours ago. Worst comes to worst, you're going to get two, but that's okay because it's free returns. Okay, so you know what happened, right? I got it. I got two orders. And of course, in each order, I ordered more than one size because it's hard to tell for sure which size is going to be right. So I got two orders of two gowns. Kept one, returning three. But the point of the story was how I don't really do these things. You know what I'm saying? Like, how often do I order gowns? How often do I pay in work? What?
And you put it on the credit card?
I did.
A Canadian credit card?
No, you left one.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because
you'll lose on
you lose
yes,
on
yes, right.
Yeah.
No, I use my
U.S. card. Yeah. So not only is they charge the service charge.
Oh, that's
so in effect, it happened to me that
right.
They ordered two. And
I had that also where I bought things and then returned it, but the exchange rate was different.
Yeah.
Right, when you return it, so you don't get back necessarily what you paid.
Yeah.
Right? It's the
best you lose right. On the service.
So I was just thinking about how, you know, like, how, like, just a week before, I was talking about how our staff is to us is, and how, you know, my son went to Vancouver, and she's from Vancouver, and how she wasn't in Vancouver when he was in Vancouver, and he's in New York, and now she's in New York, and have a beautiful
friend.
You know, the other family, yes, sir. He knew the other family. And, I'm saying, you know what, here I am, like, being a goody, like, real good talker, talking about how our staff, the staff is, I said, you know what, Tango, like, if you're saying it, you know, the whole Lisa, if you're saying it for the sit-up, you have to be saying it for this accident also. So I said, okay, see, it was so much better. I ordered the wrong gown, it was really the right gown, I had to cancel the order, reorder, and then I got to the pharmacy at exactly the time that the other car was there, so it could hit me. So it was something that, thank God, it really could have been bad, but it really should have been bad.
What happened to your car?
My car is in the shop, and I just called them today because I haven't heard anything from them. They're still waiting back to hear from the insurance because apparently the insurance just emailed them today that they need the VIN number or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of work. So the car it's body. It's
what
all body. I don't know yet.
Do you have another car?
I've been driving my husband's van, the accessible van, which has 4 seats, which is enough for the kids that are at home. The kids were home over the weekend, so we just, whatever. Saturday didn't go much, and Sunday they went to Must Be Case to the carnival party, so my sister was here, so they took 2 cars. But I don't know. But it sounds like even if they do fix it, it's going to be a couple of weeks until they can fix it.
Okay.
So thank God, it was just a car.
Okay.
Just my new car.
new car.
Okay. It happens to be, that if it was going to happen, you know, the story is meant to be, I'm happy that it happened to my new car and not to my accessible van.
Because
that's harder to replace and that would be harder for me to be without.
Oh, yeah.
Not that I go so far with my husband, but it's a big pain in the neck.
Yeah, well,
you know?
Yeah.
So that one I need, like, that one I can't have anything happen. From my perspective, anyway. Okay, so that fear was actually stuck in my mind from Tuesday, and it served me well for Friday, so thank you for that. I was well prepared. Okay, so tonight we're actually going to continue with the Hanukkah theme. Sorry, I know Hanukkah was over yesterday, but I'm still in a Hanukkah mood. We still have our Hanukkah dreidels hanging up.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got the menorah today, but
I don't
whatever.
Yeah, so remember, today was our
So yeah, okay. So today's theme happens to be a take off, a spin-off of the Hanukkah theme. So the first part has to do a little bit with Hanukkah, but really everything else is relevant all year round. So we start off with the famous story of Hannah and her seven sons. Right? So we know the famous emperor who wanted Hannah's seven sons to bow down to him. Yeah, there's the Hannah in the Navi, and then there's the Hannah in the Navi. So actually, according to Megan, I think after Shmuel was born, she didn't have other children.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. But we don't know about them. They weren't relevant to the story. But, so Hannah and her seven sons were brought before the king for disobeying the rules and for studying Torah and all the things that were forbidden at that time. So the king decided he's going to ask each of them, starting with the oldest one, to bow down to his idol and to denounce him. So the first one jumps before him and he says, "No, I will not bow down before your idol. I will serve only Hashem." And he says some kind of pasuk, or he quotes some kind of chazal from the Torah, proving that Hashem is infinite, and he's the one that we bow down to, and he's the only one that we're afraid of and that we worship. And he, of course, is killed because he does not follow the king's commands. It goes down to some two, some three, some four, with all the same response. They all have the same response. "We only bow to Hashem. We are not afraid of you. You can't intimidate us because we only fear what's eternal." And it finally gets down to the seventh son. The Gemara tells us that the seventh son was only about 2.5 years old. And he was a very precocious, very smart boy. And he said the same thing as his brothers. The problem was that the king at this point was feeling publicly humiliated. He was feeling really embarrassed because six people just made a fool out of himself in front of his room full of officers and sergeants and whatever help that a king has in those days. So he wants to say things. He says to the little one, "You know, I'll tell you something. You don't really have to bow down to the idol. I'm going to take off my ring. We'll put it on the floor. It will be in front of the idol. And all you have to do is go and pick it up." And the little boy says, "Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I know that trick. I know what you're thinking. And I pity you. I feel so bad for you that you are an adult and you are a human being that is more scared of me and the people around you than of Hashem. And I only fear Hashem. I will not listen to you. I will not fall for that trick." At 2.5 years old. Okay? So there's a lot we could say for the story. There's a lot we could focus on this family and how these children were raised and their knowledge of Torah and their depth of the Buddha. There's a lot we could say for that. But that's not what we're going to focus on today. We're going to focus now on the king. So now let's think of him. He clearly was embarrassed because he sees all of these kids who are defiant of him, not listening to him, and have another being that they're going to answer to rather than him. And he is afraid of that. And that seems odd. It seems like a really, really strange feeling for a person of his stature to have. Because if we think about it, he was the emperor. He was the king of the entire world power at that time. The world was not, you know, the other side of the world, the side of the world that we're living on now was not yet founded. Right? But there was only, you know, that empire of, you know, near Israel and Greece and that whole, you know, we call it the Middle East or the Mediterranean, whatever the official name for those areas were. That was the whole civilized world at that time. He was the world power of that time. He ruled everyone with an iron fist. He had money, he had wealth, he had fame, he had power. But he was embarrassed. He was afraid of children. He was afraid of what now he looks like in the eyes of the soldiers that's protecting him. But really, he just did kill seven people just for the fun of it. Just on the way. What is he embarrassed of and what is he feeling ashamed of or humiliated of in front of a soldier who he hired that he could get rid of at any second? So he's embarrassed? Kill him. Send him to the lion. Get rid of it. So what do we see from here? The lesson that we learn from here is that no matter how powerful a person is, and how much a person has, a person is always afraid of what others think of them. Right? We are all afraid of perception in the eyes of other people, what other people are thinking of us. And he is still looking for the approval and still looking for the admiration of the soldiers that are in the room, and he is feeling like he's lost that. And that no matter how much wealth and power he has, if this gentleman in the room is not cooing and eyeing over him, he's a nobody. He's a nothing. And Chazal tell us that that need for approval from other people also stems from an inner drive that we have for kavod, for honor, for self-respect, which comes from a lack of self-esteem. Very often, when a person is feeling lacking in themselves, they look for ways to raise themselves, sometimes to the detriment of those people around them, but they look for ways to raise themselves, and they want to make something of themselves. So really what we need to do is to realize and to recognize that we don't necessarily need the approval of other people, because we are Tzad Elokim. We are created by Hashem in the image of Hashem. As one Hashem has created us, we are like Hashem. So therefore, we should have no desire of approval for other people, and the only person and the only being that we need to be afraid of is Hashem. So the Gemara tells us that just like in Hanukkah time, the Jewish people were surrounded by a society where they were different, where they were not the same, where the culture was very much the opposite of the Jewish culture, and people looked at them funny, and they did not have the self-respect or the appreciation of the other people. We have that concept even still today. We have it both within our society, within our culture, and also just on a regular interpersonal relationship and our regular day-to-day communications with other people. We're always thinking about what will somebody say and what will somebody think and making a good impression on other people. So we call today's topic, we call it sense of self. Because what we want to do is to look into the mechanisms of this human tendency that we have. We are human. It's ingrained in us. It's built in with us, this need for approval. And what do we do with that approval? How can we get that approval? Or how can we limit our need for the approval of other people? And I discussed this concept with one of my classes over Hanukkah. And I asked them to explain and to think of a time where they felt either embarrassed or self-conscious about something. So one girl described how she came to school one day and she was wearing two different shoes. And she felt like, for sure, everybody is staring at her. And everyone was like, really? You did that? That happened to you? It was like, are you kidding? Of course it happened to me. I sat, you know, with my feet underneath my legs, the whole thing, so nobody should notice. I kept one foot tucked under, so you wouldn't see that my shoes are different. And they go, really? You didn't notice. And everyone is like sharing a story that they felt comfortable sharing about sometimes that they felt were like they wanted to hide under a rock and disappear. And most times, the stories that they told, all the girls in the class didn't even remember it. I said, girls, why do you think you don't know the story she's talking about? So we came to the conclusion that no one knew the story that she was talking about because we were also worried about what everyone was thinking about us, to be busy with worrying about what we think of her, right? We're so busy worrying about ourselves, oh my gosh, like, I'm wearing two different socks. I'm not going to notice that she's wearing two different shoes, right? So it tells us that, you know, this was the lesson of Nebuchadnezzar. Like, he had everything. He had everything. He had it all. There was nothing else that a person in his time, in his day and age, could possibly have had. But he missed out a little bit on the approval of some people that were in the room at the time. And that lost it to him. That lost it to him. So we're going to look at some other people that this happened to, and we're going to see that it could really happen to everyone and to anyone. And we'll start with some people that are more familiar, and we'll work it on with some people that are a little bit less familiar, and tie it into techniques that we could use for ourselves, because we all, you know, probably as we get older, it bothers us a little bit less, but for sure, you know, teenage years or young adult years, it's probably the only thing we're thinking about. And I think, you know, like I was telling my kids, I think I got to the point where I really don't care. You know, I almost don't care. Of course, it's not true. You know, maybe not to the extent. You know, I feel like I've reached a stage in my life where, you know, people want to talk about me, go for it, say it, you know, that's fine. But, it's really not true, because as much as we convince ourselves of that, that's how much more we really do care. We'll get to that too. Okay, so person number two, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babel, who actually destroyed the first Beit HaMikdash. He was the king that brought the Jews into their first exile out of Egypt. Out of Mitzrayim? No. Okay, same with that again. Out of Eretz Yisrael and brought them to Babylon. Right? He brought them to Babylon. It's been a long week. He brought them to Babylon. And this man was like this emperor in our first story. Similar idea is that they were both the world leaders, the world powers at their time, had everything that anyone could possibly want and anyone could possibly need and then some. So it tells us that in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, he was such an absolute monarch that nobody left. People walked around during his reign serious as to be because they were afraid to laugh, they were afraid to move a muscle because they didn't know what he was going to do. And I took that to think, you know, I was thinking about that, like trying to internalize, like, what does that mean to walk around afraid to smile and afraid to laugh, like, to always be living in such tension and such fear of what's going to happen to you. And I was thinking, like, it could be that similar to, like, communist Russia, right? Where everyone was afraid of the KGB, everyone was afraid of the communists. They didn't know who was the spy, who was not. Were there bugs, were there not? But, you know, they never knew who was going to betray them. And they, you know, if you look at people, if you look at the pictures of the time of the communists, nobody's smiling. You know, it was scary. You never knew if your own son, your own child, your own sister, your own neighbor that you're sharing a building with was going to tell on you. So same idea. Nebuchadnezzar had the power to terrify anybody. Simply to terrify anybody. Not only here in this world, but it tells us that when he died and he was sent to heaven, they were scared there too. They said, oh my God, he's coming here to rule us now. Even in Yemen, they were afraid of him. And that's a pretty, you know, pretty horrible reputation to have. So you would think, you know, the man who, like, instilled fear in the entire this world and in the entire, you know, eternal world, he has it all. But it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar had something that troubled him so. He was short. I don't know what that means. I'm not too cold myself. I don't know what that means, I'm short. But apparently he was, as I say, vertically challenged. And he lived in constant fear of his height. And the lack of his height took away from everything else that he had. And it was the only thing that he could focus on. So we see that when a person is lacking in something, when we're missing in something, we tend to focus on that, and that almost becomes who we are rather than all of the things that we do have, right? You know, the first time, nowadays, it's not really such a big deal to have glasses. Right? Nowadays, everyone wears glasses, and glasses are such a fashion statement today. People wear glasses even when they don't need them. You know, like, you look in the room, we have, you know, most of the class here, we're all wearing glasses. And I'm like, we were going to school, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, to get glasses, it was so embarrassing to come in the first day with your glasses, because everyone's going to make fun of you four eyes. Right? Nowadays, it's a fascinating. But that became who, like, for that whole day, or until we got used to it, or our friends got used to it, that's what we focused on, oh my gosh, I have glasses. Forget that I'm dressed nicely, forget that I have a family that loves me, forget that my mother packed me a delicious lunch. Right? All the things that we do have get lost in that little thing that we feel like we're lacking in, that we feel like we're missing in, and it causes us to have a lower self-esteem. It causes us to be feeling embarrassed. So what are we telling us? We're saying that we all have insecurity. We all worry about what other people think of us. But we have to focus on the fact that everything that has been gave us is what we're meant to have. So if we focus on what we have rather than what we don't have, and we pay attention to the fact that Hashem knows me, and Hashem knows what's good for me, and Hashem has designed my life to fit me and give me what I need to fulfill my purpose in life, then I'll be able to focus on the things that I do have rather on the things that I don't have. And even if society thinks that I'm missing out on something because I don't have X, Y, and Z, I'm feeling comfortable because I know I have what I need. I didn't put it on the source sheet, but I have seen a quote in that book, Battle Plans, that was quoted the other time. He says, everything I need, I have. Right? It doesn't mean you're not saying I have everything I need. You might not have everything you need, because you sometimes are feeling like you're missing things.
You don't have everything you want.
True. You also don't have everything that you need, because your needs are often wants. But everything that has been those you need, he gives you. Right? So everything I need, I have. It's a harder challenge. Yes. It's, I mean, how where you are is going to depend on how much you can internalize that and realize that. You know, someone finding it nice for us because, thank God, we're comfortable, right? Because I don't have two cars. Okay, I don't have two cars right now, but I have a car. I can get around. You know, like I have a warm house. I'm not having all of them. Right. Yeah. So that's another whole story. So we're not going to get on to that now. Okay? So let's think of another person. Somebody that you know of. You know, someone from our Torah sources that you know of that had everything you could possibly imagine except one thing.
No motion.
Right. And I want to hear your answers. I want to hear
what you're saying.
Okay, so she was lacking a child.
And Moshe wanted to go to...
But he couldn't see. He felt intimidated. He needed eyes.
Okay, so he felt... Inadequate because of his speech problem. Okay. That was Moshe, right? So Moshe had was missing that. What'd you say? What about Avram?
At the end of his life, he was still not married, so he felt like he was wanting to
make
him
married. Okay. He got married. Mm-hmm.
Right.
He married Avram again.
Right.
He didn't have a
So they were
having
okay. So I'm thinking of more, I think all of what you're saying is correct. These are all accurate things of people that were lacking something. But I'm thinking more, I'll give you a hint, let's think term time. There was a person who had everything, and he even said, I have everything.
Haman.
What did Haman have?
He had the ear of the king.
But what didn't he have? One person didn't bow down to him. Okay? Haman was the advisor to the king. I never thought of it this way. Like, okay, Haman, you know, he had everything that he could possibly have, but when he, and then he quotes, like there's a direct quote in the Megillah. But when I see Mordecai, nothing, it's all of it is not worth a thing to me. It's worth nothing to me. So we take it at face value. Mm-hmm. But then when I was preparing the sermon, I was looking at the story, it made a such a deeper impression because it pointed out how ridiculous Haman's thought was. Why? Because Haman was the ruler, or the second to the king, of 127 provinces.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. In Ottawa, there's 900,000 people in Ottawa. Okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people there are in the entire... All the entire province, all the cities. But 127 provinces, I'm gonna say something silly right now. How many provinces and territories are there in Canada? 14?
13.
5, 10, and 3. So, okay. So let's say out of the 13 provinces, there's one man who doesn't bow down to you. One. And that's making you crazy. Your whole life is worthless. You're messed up because one person didn't bow down to you. Right, that's 13. He paid for it, but he was lacking. Right, this one little thing, that to him, because he didn't, he was missing out on his self-esteem from one person. Right? 899,999 people bowed down to him, one didn't. And that's what he saw. So that's another example.
Yeah, okay. Maybe he felt like he was, you know, insulted or whatever because...
But that's the point. He was insulted because of that. One person? Yeah, 800, whatever it is, right? Millions of people are bowing down to you. You can handle one. It's okay.
He couldn't.
But he couldn't. And that's what's trying to show us. That's exactly what was trying to show us. Not only couldn't he handle it, but all the powerful things that he had were just oversighted because of that. It meant nothing. It was ridiculous. Okay. So here's another example. This was a new story. It tells us in the Mishilas Yisraelim that kavod, that the desire for honor, is one of the strongest powers, one of the strongest drives that a person has. And that for us to see ourselves as a lesser stature of a friend of ours or another person is very painful for us. It's very hard for us to watch and to witness not being on the same stature as other people. So the Gemara tells a story of Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam ben Nevat was one of the kings of the Jewish people. And I'm not that familiar with the times of the kings, but I'm not sure if he was, you know, from the Judaic side or from the Israelite side. We'll leave it as he was one of the kings of the Jewish people. And I think the story goes that when he was the time for him to pass away, so Hashem said to him, come, let you and I and King David walk together in Gan Eden. The three of us, we're going to go on a walk. You, I, Hashem, and David. And when Yerovam ben Nevat heard that, he listened, and he said, oh, the three of us are going to go for a walk. Who's going to be first? Who's going to be the leader? Who's going to be the first one at the head of the line? Now, if you listen to the words that Hashem used, it sounds like we know. He said, we'll go together, but then he said, you, I, David. So how do you put that in order? Who's first? Yerovam ben Nevat is first. Right? So if he heard the words, you, I, David, in that order, that already indicates that he is going to be first, why did he ask the question and what happened? So he asked the question because that's what he thought, but he wanted to make sure. He wanted to make sure that he really was going to be the first one to go. The problem was that once he asked the question, what happened to his stature? That went down. Because by asking that question, he lost whatever greatness he had. So now the answer was not you. The answer was David. Okay? So Hashem said, David will be the first in line. And guess what Yerovam said? Exactly. I'm not going. Okay? Yerovam had a chance to walk through Gan Eden with Hashem and with David. He could have been the first in the line, but because he wanted to make sure that he's first in the line, he lost his chance to be first in the line, but he was still in the top three. He declined. He gave it up.
I think
I know your question is very grounded, and I think everyone, the response is you feel bad for them and you don't understand them. I think it's a whole big discussion, right, about how great people could act like that. But I think what I want to kind of just zero in on is the fact that if these people are having a struggle, it just goes to show that we're normal, that we're human. Because if they're having that struggle, and they're that much greater than us, so look out for it in ourselves, because it is a challenge. We shouldn't say, well, me? That's not a problem for me. Baloney, it's not a problem for us. We're human. We're built with that vibe.
It's a mistake. In other words, it's not such a, it's not such a big to do. We can write.
We can fix ourselves. And we can learn from these. And these stories are supposed to be there to say, hey, I know what you're struggling with because even people greater than you had the same struggle.
So we shouldn't feel so bad.
Yes.
It's the same as with the story with the kids in school and their shoes. If we're always harder on ourselves than anybody else is, and nobody, you know, it's a matter of moderation.
I don't know. We are pretty hard on ourselves. You think so?
I think so. I'm pretty hard on myself. I think we all beat ourselves up. When we do something wrong, we beat ourselves up.
There's a Hungarian in Spain. It's very hard to translate that. You will notice a truth that in someone's eye that you wouldn't notice like a law, you know, But maybe we are not hard on ourselves, but we also, I also think that we often don't realize when we make a mistake, but certainly.
So we notice other people's faults more than we notice ours, but when we make a mistake, we beat ourselves up when we know about it.
I see what you're saying.
It's true. We will notice, and we'll look around the room and we'll say, oh, she did that, I have to do that, I would never do that. Yeah. But then when we do see something and we feel foolish, we beat ourselves up about it.
But it's also, you know, for some of these Gadolans to feel bad, and when we don't see that, and it's, you know, like they shouldn't feel insecure or inadequate in that. And, you know, like I just see, you know, all of this, I could talk about dynamics at work.
Right.
And, you know, but again, some people that are quite brilliant and are quite, you know, confident, but they become control freaks because they, you know, lack
it. They need that.
But on their own merits, on their own actions, their own intelligence and their knowledge,
they could be just fine with that.
Exactly.
We're getting that.
And also, is there a real key David?
Right.
At that time, he was very, like, I'm giving you a story. And he was a great gunner.
I'm saying we believe in them, and we also have to recognize that they're not angels. They're humans. But I think that's one of the points that the Torah makes, is that we don't brush it under the carpet and pretend that it didn't happen, and that our leaders are perfect. The Torah spells it all out. The Torah writes, you know, all those mistakes are right there in black and white for us to learn about and to see about, and we're not expected to be perfect. And we shouldn't, like, I don't think we're supposed to expect that our leaders are perfect. We should hold them to a higher standard.
Yeah.
And they're definitely held to a higher standard, and that's why even when it seems that they've erred, on their level it was an error, whereas on our level it might not have been, because they are being held to a higher standard. Right? So let's talk about another leader. I didn't mean this to be a leader bashing. This wasn't supposed to be a leader bashing thing, but what we're just trying to show is the human tendency and the natural instinct of a person. So I think we'll just take maybe just this one other one, I'm afraid now, you know? But it wasn't my intent. So basically, we have another person who was the Nasi of Shevet Shimon, the leader of the tribe of Shevet Shimon, whose name was Zimri ben Salu. Zimri ben Salu was the grandson of Yaakov, right? He was from Shevet Shimon. He was the grandson of Yaakov. And in the Midbar, it tells us, I mean, the passage doesn't tell us, but the Midrash tells us that he was 250 years old when the story happened. So he was not a youngster, okay? The point of the story is that this was not an issue that is relevant only to the young. This is an issue that is relevant to all of us at any age or any stage. That you might think that as a person gets older, as we age, you know, we touched on this a little bit before, that, you know, we don't care so much. We're a little bit less self-conscious. We care a little bit less. We're not so much into our kavod, our honor. It's not really true. Maybe we're a little bit less inhibited than we are as teenagers, right? But we still do care about our honor. We still do care about our respect and what other people think about us. So here we have the leader of Shevet Shimon, who actually did one of the worst things possible, and that is he had a relationship with the princess of Moab, with Cusby, and he questioned, how could that possibly have happened? Right? How could this man, the leader of the Jewish people, one of the 12 princes of the Jewish people, a grandson of Yaakov, fall and stoop to such a level. After all, my God, he was 250 years old.
Yeah.
Like, from, you know, like, really? You know, like, what happened? Yeah, 50 years are different. We have to take it relative. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know what 250 years old means, right? And, you know, even Moshe died at 120. So what? Okay, but his impression to me that he was old.
He wasn't 50.
You know, he was old. He should have known better. So how did it happen? It happened because he was home in his tent. And there was a group of people that came to him and said to him, "Hein zonim zinei nefasos, ba'akar yosei v'sosik." What does that mean in English? It says, there are people out there, there are judges and there are leaders of the Jews out there, that are judging judgments of life and death, and you're just sitting around quiet. You're just sitting around, you're doing nothing. So Zimri, who is 250 years old, hears these words, and they are an affront to his honor. They're an affront to his kavod. What does that mean? They said to him, "Hein zonim. Those people out there are judging now. You know who's judging out there? These young people. Youthful people. People who can't even be compared to you because you're so old and they're so young. They're zonim zinei nefasot. They are dealing with matters of life and death. What did you do? You're doing nothing. What were you? You were leading the Jews in the time of the desert. You didn't have to judge anything. You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to make any big decisions. You just sat there." Kavod was there. There was an affront to his kavod. There was an affront to his honor. So what does he do? He says, "What?" Because they said, "You're so safe, it's so safe. You're sitting there quietly. You're not giving you, no one's asking you for your opinion. No one wants to know what you have to say about this. Like, look what's happened to you. You're just like an old nobody." And that did not go over well. That did not go over well with the man. He's not an old nobody. So what happened? He went out. He gathered 24,000 people of the Jews and went out and did the worst possible. So, you know, built himself. So it happens. And it happens at any age that we're never really, you know, we're never really safe from it. We always have to work on ourselves. And again, a quick story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? The famous story of the two men. One was invited to the party and one was not. And the person who wasn't invited went and told and how it led to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That was all because of kavod. You didn't get invited to the party. Oh. Right? You know, you got kicked out of the party. Oh. But it's these are serious things, right? The different ages and stages of our life, this stuff is really, really serious. Okay, so let's move on. We're going to look at some of the techniques and how we could do, what we can do to implement, to try to be aware of this natural tendency within us and what we could tell ourselves. So we're going to look at a Rabbeinu Yonah in a Sar HaAvoda. And he says that what we need to do is that the most important thing we need to do is for a person to recognize and to realize that individually, as an individual, we are greatness. We are great people. We are something special. We're special and we come from special people. We come from great people. We come from the Bnei Yisrael. We come from great people. And that Hashem loves us and Hashem loves those that we come from. And by concentrating and focusing on this, and bringing it to all new levels, because we can know something on one level, we can know something on an intellectual level, but there's always multiple levels of being able to internalize in something and to really understand it and to really believe it. Like when we first started, it might just be lip service. Like it might just be something that we say, and we know we're supposed to mean it, but until it actually registers within us, it takes time, or it could take years, or it might not take right away, right? So we said we have, right, and this is something that we should teach ourselves, so that at that time it comes a chance where we have something, and we have a choice in front of us, where we need to do something, we need to make a choice, and we're not sure if we want to do something or not, and perhaps there's a situation that lies in front of us that's not really appropriate for us, and we could tell ourselves, and rethink to ourselves, and say, does that befit me? Am I befitting? Should I be doing that now? Or is that beneath my level? Is that beneath my stature? I'm descendant of Bnei Yisrael. I'm a descendant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I'm descendant of you know, whoever my mother, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather was, is that how a child of so-and-so would act? Is that how a child of so-and-so would behave? How could I do this? And to build ourselves up that way by recognizing that as a Jew, and we have our own internal greatness, and Hashem loves us and cares about us because of that very fact, even on its own. And I think we were talking about, I think that Mrs. Kim touched on that before, when then we had this whole discussion about with our friends and, you know, looking out, you know, what we notice in other people, what we notice in ourselves. So one technique that's also given by the Dr. Kingdom is that because it's hard for us to see ourselves, like because we're so hard on ourselves, it's hard for us to see the good in us, so we should look for the good in other people. So that by learning to train ourselves to see good in others, mm-hmm. it will in turn train us to see the good in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that might be easier for to see the same way that we, you know, we said before, you know, we notice the flaws of other people. So instead of looking for other people's flaws, let's look for other people's positive qualities. And what we notice, oh, wow, look at her. She's friendly. Hey, I'm also friendly. Oh, wow, she does so much chesed. She drops those food for somebody to count it. Okay, I can do that. I can do chesed. I can do this. And then by noticing other people's qualities, to find those qualities in ourselves. And then we'll know ourselves better, and that will build us up as well. Because as we've been saying all along, the whole thing is this lack of self-esteem. The desire for kavod, the desire for honor, the desire for more respect from others is when we're feeling a lack of respect for ourselves. So how we build up respect for ourselves, of ourselves, so that we don't need the admiration of others as much. Right? Another explanation is that, what was I saying? Okay, what they knew, Yonah. Okay, I think we're going to... Oh, here, let's take the story of Ruth. Okay, we're going to take the story of Ruth. Ruth was a princess. Ruth was a princess of Moab. She was accustomed to a very high lifestyle. She was very accustomed to a very high standard. And she married the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, of Naomi and Elimelech, who had escaped from Eretz Yisrael because of a hunger in the land, and they went to Moab. And that's where these two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, married these two Moab princesses. And you know the story, you know, the second sister, Arpa, left, and then it was just, and then the first, the father died, and then the two sons died. They were penniless, they had nothing. And all that was left was Naomi and the daughter-in-law Ruth. And really, they were left with nothing. They left to escape the famine so they wouldn't have to help to protect the other people. And they themselves came back destitute with nothing, with, you know, much worse than when they had left. So they were coming now back to Israel. They were in the position of being beggars. They needed handouts from other people. They had nothing. And there was a mikvah in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, in the times of Eretz Yisrael, for the farmers to leave out certain portions of their crops and of their land for poor people to come and to collect. They should be able to sustain themselves and still maintain their dignity. So Ruth goes out to collect for Naomi, her mother-in-law. She's younger than her mother-in-law. This is Naomi home. And she comes home one day with, you know, food and wheat and whatever it is, stock. And she brings it home. And Naomi is curious. Where have you been today? Where have you gone? What have you done? Where did you get all of this food? How did it come about? So Ruth says, well, the name of the person that I did a kindness for today was Boaz. Now, here's what she's saying. The name of the person that I did a kindness to was Boaz? I think she has something wrong there, right? She should have said, the name of the person that did a kindness to me today was Boaz. After all, she's the destitute one. She went to his field, took his food, and now has what to eat. He did you a kindness. What do you think you did for him? It sounds a little bit, like, wacky.
I got him a chance to do a mitzvah.
Exactly. So what is this? She's saying, the person that I did a favor to, because by me going to his home, to his field to collect his food, he got a mitzvah that's worth so much more than these little stalks of grain that I took from him. But still. Really? Really? You know, like you go to someone's house, you're collecting for tzedakah, and you say, yeah, got you! You got a mitzvah! It's all because of me! Hooray! Right? So really, you should look at it that way on the one hand, but on the other hand, it sounds like...
You sound like you're the one giving.
Right?
When you're the one giving, you're supposed to say, thank you for giving me
the opportunity. We say, how could Ruth? So, you know, the mother of the Jewish people, like the mother of David Hamela, like the kings of Yehuda come from her. She must have been somebody great. We know she was a special person. Like, who was she to come out talking like this? So Chazal tell us that by Ruth being in the position of being a beggar, her self-esteem was lower. She felt very low. She felt very small. And it was not an it was a very uncomfortable feeling. It didn't feel good to be the receiver, to be on the receiving end. It was especially, nobody wants to be on the receiving end. And especially someone like her, who was used to all the finest qualities of life, it was a horrible feeling. So she was afraid that if she stayed on that level of low self-esteem, she would plummet. Right, when a person has low self-esteem, when a person is not feeling good about themselves, they usually don't act in the best of ways because they don't care anyway. Right, when we're sad or when we're upset or we're in a bad mood, do we care about what we eat? Do we care about what we wear? Do we care about what we do? We don't, because who cares anyway? So she was afraid that this feeling of being on the receiving end was going to get to her. And she was going to be like, well, who cares anyway? I'm just a nobody anyway. So what she had to do was to use a technique to build herself up so she can maintain a healthy level of self-esteem. Not that she would be bragging. She wasn't trying to brag her and to boast and build herself up higher than someone else. She was trying to hire herself in her own eyes and to remind herself that just because she's on the receiving end now, she's still somebody great, and she still has greatness to her, and she still deserves to have self-respect, and she should still maintain her own dignity and her own honor. And
but she was looking at her mother a lot of the day that I'm going to
sure.
You know, so I mean, she was doing it really to help her mother.
Yeah, but it's painful, right?
Yeah,
you know, right? So that's the truth. So she was really afraid of that, and she was doing it to make sure that she maintains the high level of herself. So what we see, like, from this whole package, what do we see? There are feelings of inferiority, feelings of feeling small, of unhappy, of sadness, of depression, whereas that is not healthy. But the Torah view tells us that everything that we have, or the things that we don't have, are not the things that make us. Right? Like, you know, there's the expression, you are what you eat. We are not what we eat. We are not what we wear, and we are not the car that we drive, and we're not, I don't know, the shoes we wear, whatever it is. We are not the things about us.
The physicalities.
And the total view does not measure us by what we have in our physical world. So other people might be looking at us and what we do and don't have it in our physical world, but we know that our physical world is what's given to us by Hashem. And only what Hashem says that we need for our toolbox. Everyone in this world was put into this world with a toolbox, with a kit of all the things that we need, our supplies, to do what we do best and to be ourselves. Right? The same way that we'll have the dishwasher repairman come in. He comes with a toolbox that has certain equipment, that has certain tools. The elevator guy came with different tools, and, I don't know, the florist has different tools. Everyone has their own tools based on their job. So what I have is not me, per se. It's my tools. So we're not going to measure ourselves based on the tools we have, and we're not going to measure ourselves on the tools that we don't have. We don't measure ourselves against other people's circumstances, because according to other people's circumstances, we might have less, we might have more, others might have more, others might have less. But our intrinsic value is that internal, is that which what's inside of us, and to maintain that pride of who we are, that Hashem loves us, Hashem cares about us, Hashem provides for us, and all the wonderful things of what makes us individuals is what should shine through and help us to look at ourselves in that best light so that we can see and be proud of who we really are and not what we're not having. Yes, I'm vertically challenged and proud of it.
Some small passes.
Just some small passes, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more class next week. And then I think it's going to be too much for me to hold the classes while I'm getting ready for the chasana. So we have to send after Pesach. After the chasana, we'll do another semester. And it's cold.
It's not too cold,
right? Yes.
You didn't get the right email from her.
I sent to the wrong email?
Yeah.
Oh,
I'll have to give you
so
right.
Give it to me again.
Yeah, she's interested.
Okay, okay, good. Okay, so now
the poster put on?
Yes, that is. Okay, so now the poster. Disconnect audio.
Might as well have our